Okay, there's three parts to my talk. I'll start with a very brief introduction, keep it brief since we already heard lots of talks about this topic. Then I'll talk first about a global analysis of a large set of quasar spectra using a statistical pixel technique. And after that, I'll talk a little bit about some special clouds that seem to be very highly enriched, but which may have global consequences. Of course, I didn't do this work by myself. I had lots of collaborators. I listed them here and there in alphabetical order, which has the advantage that the person who did most of the work actually comes out in front, which is Anthony Aguirre here and Bob Carsall for the second part. Now, why do we care about intergalactic metals? Well, there are several reasons why we care, and I listed just a few. We heard most of these already. This one we didn't really hear about. To me, it's also interesting by itself. Since the intergalactic medium contains most of the volume and most of the mass in the universe, we'd like to know what its composition is. Sorry?
Baryonic mass.
Most of the baryonic mass, sure, yeah. I'd like to know the other composition as well as the dark matter, but I won't be able to give you any wisdom on that. We can learn about galactic winds, feedback from star formation, because star formation produces metals and they're winds will distribute them through the IGM. It may not be the only process, but it's certainly something that we can learn from. Since metals are produced in stars, if we would know the metallicity of the universe as a function of time, we would learn something about the different stars that are being made. Also, if we know different abundance of different elements, we can learn about the yields and therefore about the type of stars, the initial mass function of the stars. And finally, I'll come back to this as well, metals are very important for the cooling of the gas. Here's just a little cartoon-type picture that John Webb made of a quasar spectrum. Here's the Lyman Alpha emission line. That's the Lyman Alpha forest. Here's a damp Lyman Alpha system, the systems that Art was talking about just now. And what I want to point out is where some of the different transitions that I'll be talking about fall. So hydrogen is all that stuff, hydrogen Lyman Alpha. Over here, rightwards of Lyman Alpha, we have carbon-4 and silicon-4. So that's why you hear a lot about those things. They're easy because there's not much contamination. However, there's other interesting transitions as well. There's silicon-3, which falls over there, carbon-3 is over there, and oxygen-6, which is also over there. So if you want to study those transitions, which are actually very strong, and these are very abundant elements, oxygen especially, and the transitions are strong, you have to deal with all that contamination. But if you're going to look by eye, it's going to be very difficult to find those transitions and to say anything useful. And that's why a statistical technique is very important and can be very powerful. So, the second part then. The pixel optical depth technique was pioneered by Tony Songela and Lankawi a couple of years ago. What we've done is we've refined it, we tested it extensively with simulations, and we also added simulations to the analysis phase to be able to do more in terms of interpretation. I don't have time to go in all of the details, but the basic picture of what we're doing is well illustrated by this plot. What you do is you take a quasar spectrum and you measure the optical depth in some transition at every pixel. So you have an optical depth in some transition as a function of redshift. And there's all kinds of corrections that go into measuring that optical depth. You try to correct for contamination, for example. You can do that for two different transitions, for example, carbon-4 and hydrogen-1, neutral hydrogen, and you can plot them against each other. So this is the carbon-4 optical depth, the log of the carbon-4 optical depth, as a function of the log of the hydrogen optical depth, and we take the median in each H1 bin. And what you get is something that looks like that. Here's data for one particular quasar spectrum, Q1422 at redshift 3.6, which is the best one that was available to us. Then what you can do is you can take a theoretical model which tells you what kind of density corresponds with what kind of Lyman alpha optical depth. Now, to do that, you basically need to know the intensity of the ionizing background. That you can measure from the same data by matching the overall Lyman alpha absorption with the overall intensity of the UV background, as Jennifer was talking about a few days ago. So once you know that, that's essentially all you need to know. You also need to assume that it's photoionized, not collisionally ionized. So the temperature has to be much less than 10 to the 5 K. At that point, you know the density at each of those points. If you know the density, you know the ionization balance. So you can correct for the fact that carbon-4, triply ionized carbon, is not all the carbon there is, and that neutral hydrogen is not all the hydrogen there is. Once you do that, what you get out is a metallicity as a function of density. Now, if you have simulations, then of course you can test some of these assumptions. You can't test the assumptions that way. You can test the details of the technique, see if the technique gives a reasonable result given those assumptions. What you can do is you can measure that metallicity distribution as a function of density, put it back in a simulation, produce artificial spectra, and do the same analysis on the spectra and see if you get the same result. And that is shown here as a dashed line for this simulation. Now, you can do more than the median, of course. You can also look at a different percentile. Median is just the 50th percentile. For example, here's the 69th and the 84th percentile. And that gives you insight into the distribution of metals, the width of the distribution at a given density. What we find for this quasar is a carbon abundance relative to solar of -4, which is goes roughly an order of magnitude up with an order of magnitude increase in the overdensity. That's the density contrast here, this delta. And it's a very wide distribution. The scatter is very large. It's consistent with a log normal distribution with a width of almost a dex.
Is it delta or 1.0?
It's delta. It's density divided by the mean density. One plus delta, then, yeah, sorry, yeah. Now, we've done that not just for one quasar, but for a whole set of 19 high-quality spectra taken with the Keck and VLT telescopes, spanning redshifts 2 to 4.5, roughly. And if we then try to fit a simple model for the metallicity to all of these spectra, we find that we actually can get away with that. A simple model is consistent. And the simple model we tried here has, actually, I didn't even write it down, but it's a power law function of both redshift and overdensity. And what you get out here, for if you look only at redshift 3, is, for example, shown here for the median. Here's the median carbon abundance as log as function of log overdensity. What you get out is that that metallicity is a strong function of overdensity. Now, one thing that I didn't tell you yet, and what I want to emphasize, is that there is a strong dependence on what you assume that the UV background looks like. The intensity we have a handle on. We can normalize the hydrogen ionization rate by actually looking at the mean Lyman alpha absorption. But the spectral shape is not constrained by these observations, so we have to assume something. And this black curve, what that assumes is a Hart-Madaus spectrum with quasars and galaxies. Galaxies with an escape fraction of 10%. If you say we only have quasars, we have a much harder spectrum, but with the same hydrogen ionization rate, you get this green curve. At low overdensities, you get much higher metallicities. And you can see that the errors due to this uncertainty in the UV background are much more important here than the statistical errors. There's quite a bit of uncertainty in the metallicity of the low-density IGM. And this is if you make it softer. If above redshift 3.2, you cut off the radiation above 4 Rydbergs by a factor of 10. You get an even lower metallicity here. As a function of redshift is shown here, we don't see much evidence for evolution for any of these models. Another thing we've done here, should just want to briefly mention. Actually, I'm going to skip over this now because I want to do. I'm going to go back to this later. You can do other things than carbon 4 and hydrogen 1, for example. In this paper that Anthony Aguirre was the lead author on, what we did here is we did the same game, but we plotted silicon 4 as a function of C4. And we compare that with simulations. And in the simulations, we just tweaked the silicon to carbon ratio until we got agreement. And you can see that it is possible to get a good agreement for the median as well as the higher percentiles. And that's all for a single silicon to carbon ratio. So that's interesting. So I showed you already there's a lot of scatter in the carbon distribution for a fixed hydrogen value. That doesn't seem to be the case for silicon as a function of carbon, right? There's no scatter in this ratio, yet we can match the full distribution. Another thing that's interesting is that the value comes out to be quite high. Now, that is, again, sensitive to the spectral shape of the UV background that we assume. If we assume it's quasars only, it would be about 30 times overabundant relative to carbon silicon. Now, that seems crazy. So that's another indication that the radiation field is not that hard. If we take an extremely soft model, we get 0.5 here instead of 0.7. So it seems if you want something consistent with stars, which is about 0.5, low metallicity stars, you need a very soft UV background. And there's no escape that silicon is overabundant relative to carbon in the IGM. So you're just summarizing a few of these results. Metallicity is a stronger function of overdensity than of time. Distribution of metals is very inhomogeneous. At low overdensities, the spectral shape of the UV background is very important. silicon and carbon originate in the same stars. That comes from the statement that the scatter is very small in a silicon to carbon ratio. If you had different population, different IMS producing the silicon and carbon we observe, you would expect a lot of scatter in that ratio. Silicon is highly overabundant relative to carbon, and that comes from carbon 3, analyzing carbon 3 as a function of carbon 4. If the metals were hot, if they were collisionally ionized, the temperature was 10 to the 5 K or higher, we wouldn't see any carbon 3, and we would still see some carbon 4. We do see carbon 3, and it's consistent with photoionization temperatures, but it rules out these high temperatures. Renyu Chen showed this picture as a simulation we did with Tom Tuns in 2002. Simulation, one time we had very strong feedback implemented from star formation, another time there was no feedback at all. What is shown here is the log of the overdensity, if there is feedback and if there is no feedback, and the same for the log of temperature. So what you can see is that if there are galactic winds, you blow these bubbles. You also have some bubbles without galactic winds, it's just from shock heating, gravitational infall. But the density doesn't seem to be very different. And you can also see that the bubbles preferentially go into the voids. They leave these filaments roughly intact. And we found, and it's all in the paper, that if you do the all statistical analysis of the Lyman alpha force, the H1 Lyman alpha force, you see almost no difference, whether there's feedback or non-feedback. Now, what you, of course, would like to know is whether these kind of simulations produce metal absorption that looks anything like what we see, what I just showed you. Now, one way to do that is to just compare the metallicity as a function of density that the simulation predicts and compare it with what I just told you about. But we already heard there's a lot of potential pitfalls if you do it that way. For example, in our conversion from hydrogen Lyman alpha optical depth to overdensity, we assume pure photoionization. If the gas is hot, that's going to be wrong. It's going to give you the wrong answer. So what you really want to do is you want to take a simulation like this, put artificial sight lines through it, and compare directly the optical depth statistics with the observations. Now, that's what we've done, and this is all written up in a paper, another one that Egeri et al. Is the first author on, that will come out probably next week on AstroPH. We've done this not only for the simulation I just showed you, Tuns et al. 2002, we've also done it for one of the Springle and Hernquist simulations that many people have already showed results from. Now, what we find for carbon 4 divided by H1 as a function of H1 is shown here. So the data. This is now from about 10 quasar spectra between redshift 2.5 and 4, all lumped together, so it's all binned together. And this dotted line is the model that we inferred from the observations, put in a simulation without feedback. You can see it's a good fit, except here at the very high end. However, there's only a few quasars that are determining these pixels. However, if you look at the feedback simulations, these simulations that include galactic winds, they predict carbon 4 optical depths that are far too low. And it doesn't really matter which UV background model you use. These are all different UV background models. It doesn't really matter whether you use a simulation with the feedback implementation done by Tom Tuns and Scott Kay or Springle and Hernquist, you get something that's very wrong. You can do the same thing for carbon 3 divided by carbon 4 as a function of carbon 4. And again, without feedback, you get a fairly good fit. If you do put in the feedback, you predict ratios that are far too low. We put in the metals by hand according to the distribution that we measured.
And in the other case, you put them in through the simulation.
The other case is just pure prediction of the simulation. We don't change anything. So that's temperatures around 10 to the 4K. What it exactly it is doesn't matter in that case so much. But collision ionization is not important. I'll get. No. So this one is a simulation that doesn't have any feedback in it. Sorry? So in these simulations, it's just predicted by the simulation. This one, it's the distribution that we measured that I just discussed before, where we measure the metallicity as a function of overdensity and redshift and the scatter in it. Exactly. That's what we do. It's just a verification that our measurement is for that simulation consistent with the observations. It's just a check, a consistency check. We put in what we want to get out, exactly. Now, why could there be such a big discrepancy? Well, this picture from the simulation by Tuns et al. Gives some insight into what one of the things that is certainly very different in these simulations that do include galactic winds compared to the one that doesn't. And that is that if you plot the log of the metallicity as a function of log temperature, And this is only done for particles that actually do contain metals. Most of them don't contain any metals. Then what you find is that most of the metals, there's also some contours here, most of the points are around here, are metal-rich and hot. So this assumption of photoionization is certainly going to break down for these metals. And most of these are so hot that they don't generate any C4 or H1 absorption. So most of the metals are just not seen in these lines. And that clearly leads to an underprediction of the optical depth. However, and I should say that the Spiegelman-Hornquist plot version of this plot looks very similar, even though the feedback implementation is quite different. Both of these simulations do not include metal cooling. And if you just compute the cooling time for these particles at these metallicities and temperatures, and for the densities, this color coding is according to log over density, then you find that many of these particles, the gas should be cooling. I should warn you that that may not actually be true. In reality, since these metallicities are very high, partly because SPH is a discrete description of the gas, and once you put the metals in a particle close to a starburst galaxy, if that particle flows out, the metals cannot distribute, they cannot diffuse out. However, so what we did is we said, what happens if we just ignore that and we were optimistic, we say, all this gas can cool if the cooling time is shorter than the Hubble time, which implicitly also assumes that the heating occurred at redshift infinity. Now, if you do that, here's this again, the previous picture to show you the contrast. So that's without any cooling by metal, still cooling of hydrogen, helium is of course included. If you do that, you get much more C4 absorption, right? So cooling is very important. In the case of this simulation, you actually get even too much, and you get a reasonable fit.
But this is assuming the cooling doesn't affect the dynamics.
Exactly, which is a wrong assumption.
How do you predict the carbon-4 after cooling? You just assume again the low temperature at an equilibrium?
We put the temperature at 10 to the 4K. The exact value doesn't really matter. And we assume ionization equilibrium at that temperature. With photoionization.
So it's really just an excuse for putting the carbon 4 back in.
Exactly. I don't want to say that this is going to be right. The simulation should be done again with metal cooling. It's just indicating that it's important, that it makes a big difference.
How short is the cooling time compared with the escape time, right, or the floor time, right? I mean, that's the key question about the dynamical issue. I mean, is it actually the case that stuff just gets there faster? In which case it wouldn't matter.
By asymptotic velocity, you mean for the wind?
The outflow velocity, right? I mean, if it essentially converts a lot of thermal energy into expansion and then cools, right, then it wouldn't affect the dynamics very much.
That's true. The cooling times here are very long, actually, still. There's one curve here where we say, that's this dotted line, instead of the cooling time being shorter than the Hubble time, we require it to be shorter than 10% of the Hubble time. And that should be compared with the blue line, so you can see it makes quite a big difference. So most of the gas has a cooling time of order the Hubble time, so it's not clear it's actually going to cool in reality. Now, so this is just to illustrate that this might be potentially important. However, this is not all the information we have. I showed you that we also have the C3 information. And I should stress that that is one of the big advantages of this pixel optical depth method. Right? This is not a way you can do that by eye, or you can do void profile line fitting in this mess where C3 occurs. Another big advantage is that this kind of analysis is only possible if you have an objective, automated, fast algorithm. Otherwise, you can't compare with simulations. Now, what happens if you do the C3? This is what it looked like before, C3 over C4 divided by C4. Now you put in very optimistic cooling prescription, and it gets worse. That's interesting. Why does it get worse? Well, there's two ways in which you can get C3 over C4 to be very low. One is if you have collisional ionization, you have high temperatures. And because at that point, C3 gets collision ionized before C4 does. Another way to do it is to have the density being too low. Because if it's photoionized, C3 over C4 is essentially proportional to the gas density. So what this is saying is that if the gas were able to cool, the density would be far too low, of the density of the metals in the simulations that have galactic winds. And that is related to the fact that these winds propagate into the voids rather than being located into the filaments. So you want the metals at higher densities than they are in these simulations.
Is that a time-dependent ionization calculation or a time-independent?
Time-independent. Assumes ionization equilibrium.
So in fact, you could run into real problems of non-time-independence in the ionization
pattern. If the heating occurred in the last 100 million years or so, then for the metals, not for the hydrogen, For the hydrogen, the ionization equilibrium will be established on 10,000 years after it cools down. But for the metals, it can take a lot longer.
If you go up to high temperature, achieve ionization balance, and then do cooling, you're going to go way out of the ionization equilibrium.
For the metals, for about 100 million years. For the hydrogen, only for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
I want to postpone discussion a little bit, because I'm certainly not going to get to the end. But I just want to say some of the conclusions from this work is that in the simulations, these are SPH simulations without metal cooling, but with galactic winds, the metals are too hot, residing gas are too low density, and I haven't discussed this, but we also have information from the observation on the distribution of metallicity for a given density. Well, that also is far totally wrong in the simulations. It's far too inhomogeneous. The real universe is inhomogeneous, but not that inhomogeneous. I didn't have time to get into that. Possible solutions. Well, metal cooling, we know that must be important. It's not included, so that should be done. Another thing is that the feedback prescription may be wrong. So we might be able to learn something about galactic winds. Another thing is that maybe the metals we're seeing are not coming from these winds. Maybe they are hot and invisible, but most of them came from much earlier generations of stars that are not resolved by these simulations, maybe at very high redshift. Clearly, the point you should take away from all this is that we can really learn something. There's an opportunity to learn something here. OK, the final part of my talk is an unrelated analysis of some special absorption systems. I talked about this before. Some of you may have heard me talk about it. Since then, we made a lot of progress, but it's not in these view graphs. So I didn't have time to update them. I'll say a bit about what we did. We redid the whole analysis. The results are consistent, so don't worry. So sometimes you see some strange individual systems. And they're strange in the sense that if you look here at carbon-4, it's a carbon-4 doublet compared with hydrogen. This is all as a function of velocity relative to the line center. Carbon-4 is much stronger than hydrogen. Normally, it's the other way around. Hydrogen is normally 100 to 1,000 times stronger than carbon. So this is unusual. Another thing that's unusual here is that there might be nitrogen-5 absorption. And nitrogen-5 falls in the Lyman alpha-4, so there's always an issue of contamination. So it's really an upper limit. But that's unusual because you almost never see nitrogen-5 absorption in the forest. Oxygen-6 may also be present. Here's another example, which is a bit more clear. Hydrogen is weak. Carbon is strong. We also see carbon-3 here, carbon-4, nitrogen-5 doublet, and the oxygen-6 doublet. So what could these things be? Well, here are the general characteristics of these absorbers that we find. And we looked in about 10 VLT spectra for these, found about 10 of them in those spectra. And actually, we did it again. Initially, and all the results that I'll be showing you are from that initial analysis, we selected them by possible nitrogen-5 absorption. So whenever we saw nitrogen-5, that was possible there, consistent doublet ratio, we said that's such a system. And then we found, as I'll show you, that nitrogen actually is overabundant for these systems. Of course, then you get worried because you selected by nitrogen-5. So we redid the whole analysis using a very different way of line fitting. Instead of fitting void profiles to everything and trying to deblend all the lines, we did only that for carbon-4. But for hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen-5, we just made an automated fitter that Bob wrote and only determined upper limits to all the lines. And that should be robust, even if it's blended, because we don't take blends into account. We just determine upper limits. And that works out very well for what we're interested in, actually. But what we got from the initial analysis is that a typical C4 column density is about 10 to the 13 of these systems. And the hydrogen is a little bit smaller than that usually. They're very narrow, so collision ionization is typically not important. About half of them are single components. The other half are multiplets. But one-third of them are associated with relatively strong hydrogen systems, but the other two-thirds are not. And the velocity spreads vary up to about 150 kilometers per second. We also checked, using the statistics, whether they're correlated with the position of the QSO or not. They seem to be clearly intervening. And we checked, using line ratios and the line widths, whether photoionization is a good assumption. It certainly seems to be the case. So then we want to measure the physical parameters of these systems. And the way we did that is by assuming, first of all, that we know the UV background. We took, again, the Hartmann-Mandel model. Second, we assumed that carbon over oxygen is intrinsically or roughly solar. Now, if you make those assumptions, you can measure all the properties of these systems. One way to do this is to compare the carbon-4 over oxygen-6 ratio that you measure with one that you predict for this density. So if you assume that you know the intrinsic carbon of oxygen ratio, and you assume it's photoionized, then the ratio that you measure just depends on the density. Higher density systems have more carbon-4 relative to oxygen-6. So you can measure that. So that's done here. Once you know the density, you know the ionization balance, including the neutral hydrogen fraction. If you know the neutral hydrogen fraction, and you can measure the neutral hydrogen column density, you know the size of the system. That's done here. Right? In the new case, we only have an upper limit on this H1 column density. We get an upper limit on the size. We only have an upper limit on the oxygen-6 column density, which gives us a lower limit on the density. Now, finally, if you then also know the C4 column density, which we know, you can get the metallicity. You can do it with other ratios as well. Instead of assuming that carbon over oxygen is known, you can assume that you know some other ratio. You get roughly the same answers. Now, what we get out of this ionization modeling for our data set is shown here. What is shown here is log of size in parsecs versus log of number density of hydrogen. And what you see is that most of these systems are quite small. There's 100 parsecs here. And they're not so dense. The mean density of the universe at its redshift is a little bit less than 10 to minus 5. So they're over-dense by 10 to 100, but no, they're not very, very dense clouds. Of course, if they were, we wouldn't see these high ionization lines. The typical mass that you infer then is about 10 solar mass. It's very uncertain because there's a cube here that fell off the plot because it goes as the third power of the radius, of course, which is uncertain. But what is clear is that the size of these systems is much smaller than the genes length for that density and for a temperature consistent with photoionization. Right? Normal Lyman alpha forest clouds have a size that's consistent with the genes length, which means that they're roughly in hydrostatic equilibrium. And that size is about 100 kpc. So we're looking at things that are much smaller, which means that they're not self-gravitating unless they would be very highly dark matter dominated. And the metallicity of these systems is high. It's here is solar, here is a tenth of solar, and it's plotted as a function of radius. So they're metal rich, solar metallicity, roughly. Relative abundances, we have silicon 4 for a bunch of these systems, most of them only upper limits, seems to be consistent with solar. Here's nitrogen 5, and you see it's typically overabundant in nitrogen. With our new analysis with the upper limits on nitrogen and hydrogen oxygen, it actually goes away, and they're consistent with solar. I'm going to skip over that. Now, how do these things compare with galaxies? We see about 4 of these systems per unit redshift. It's a little bit higher with the new analysis that's less more conservative. Now, if you to get that rate of incidence for a size of a cloud of 100 parsecs, which is what we inferred from ionization modeling, you would have a number density per unit volume, a co-moving number density per unit volume, of about 10 to the 4 per cubic megaparsec. Well, the number doesn't mean much to you, but if you compare it with galaxies, here's Chuck's Lyman break galaxies at redshift 3, they have a number density that's 6 orders of magnitude lower. So these things are very, very abundant in terms of number. That's integrating the luminosity function down to 0.1 L star. You can say it another way. If you want all of these things to be associated with Lyman break galaxy, you can ask, how big does the halo of these Lyman break galaxies have to be that contains these kind of systems to produce that number density? And the answer is that it needs to be about 68 kiloparsecs, a radius, for a covering factor of unity. So you need to go out to about 100 kpc with these, around each Lyman break galaxy if you want them to be in those halos. It's interesting, that's roughly the scale that winds were supposed to do things. And you can also ask how much metals are contained in this population of clouds. Because we know the size of them, we know how many we see per unit redshift, we know the number density, we know the metallicity. Now, what you get then is a metallicity of about 10 to the minus 5 times the metallicity of these systems, which is about solar. So the total metallicity in these systems, in this population, is low. However, they may be more important on the in a cosmological sense than you think, because they're probably not in equilibrium. I show you that they cannot be self-gravitating. If they're not self-gravitating, they're probably expanding unless they're pressure confined. Now, let's assume they're freely expanding. If they're freely expanding, the characteristic lifetime is just the size of the system divided by the sound speed, which is about 10 kilometers per second, gives you a characteristic scale of about 10 to the 7 years. Now, if that really is their ages, then the number of systems that have gone through this phase is much larger than the number of systems at any given time that are in this phase. And the difference, they're higher by the Hubble time over that lifetime. And it gives you a total amount of metals that have gone through this kind of population of about 10 to the minus 2 of solar, which exceeds the metallicity of the IGM. So it's quite possible that all the metals that are now in the IGM have at once resided in these kind of high metallicity clouds. Now, how sure are we that these things are short-lived? Could they be long-lived? Well, one way to have them long-lived is to make them pressure-confined. However, since we know that the hydrogen column associated with these clouds is low, we better not see the hydrogen absorption by the environment that does the pressure confining. If we don't want to see the hydrogen absorption, the medium has to be hot. The hydrogen has to be collisionally ionized, means the medium has to be at least 10 to the 5 Kelvin. We want the pressure to be the same as the pressure in these clouds, which is very low, which means that you need a density of about 10 to the minus 5 particles per cubic centimeter or lower if the temperature is higher. It's already weird to have such a high temperature at such a low density, but let's go on. If there were no magnetic fields, then these clouds would evaporate in about 10 times the expansion time, and that's about 10 to the 7 years, as I showed you. If they're moving with some speed, relative speed in that medium, they would also be hydrodynamically unstable, and you would expect them to be destroyed on a timescale that's not very different from this expansion timescale. It depends on the square root of the density of the clouds divided by the density of the medium, and here's the sound speed of the clouds, 10 kilometers per second, and that's the relative speed relative to the medium. So you would expect them to be short-lived. However, if they were self-gravitating, that wouldn't be the case. But for them to be self-gravitating, the dark matter has to dominate over the gas by mass by a million to one. So the total mass of these halos would then be about 10 to the 7 solar masses. Interestingly enough, if you pick a mini-halo with a viral radius of about 100 parsecs, let it form a high redshift, and you then say, let's put some gas in it until you get hydrostatic equilibrium, you get roughly these numbers, and you get also roughly the right number density of these systems. But anyway, let's forget that speculation. Let's speculate a bit more. So what could happen with these systems, right? We know that at this moment, they're probably not in pressure equilibrium. If you imagine that for example, in a galactic wind or whatever astrophysical object you prefer, that you start out with very dense, high metallicity clouds that blow out into a low pressure medium, we'd expect them to start expanding. Now, they will expand until they're destroyed or until they're pressure confined. Now, these clouds are 10 to the 4K when we see them. The medium is also 10 to the 4K. So if they were pressure confined, that means that the density of the medium has to be the same as the density of the clouds. Right? That would be the final situation. So basically, then, what you're talking about is just a localized patch of metals in the diffuse medium. However, the medium, we know, has a coherence scale of the Gene scale. And that's much larger than the size of this cloud. So we know that in that case, the hydrogen column density that we would see would be much larger than the one we see now. In other words, the system would look like an ordinary metal system. It would just be a high H1 column with some normal carbon-4 column. So they look like ordinary metal systems. So the reason that we see these as special may just be because they happen to be in a low-density environment, and they haven't reached pressure equilibrium yet. Most of these, of course, would have reached pressure equilibrium already. In that case, they would look like normal systems. So the prediction would be that maybe all metal systems are in these type little clouds. Maybe all metal systems are just, the metals are very inhomogeneous on parsec scales or hundreds of parsec scales. That would be consistent with all these observations. So the prediction would be that an ordinary carbon-4 system is much smaller than the H1 that corresponds to it, which is roughly 100 kpc. Now, that prediction can actually be tested using ionization models that I just did, but of course, there's no test because that's what I used to infer it. You can also use gravitationally lensed quasar pairs. You have two sight lines, and you can see what the coherence length of the C4 is. And there are actually some observations of that. Michael Rauch and Wolf Sargent have done a lot of work on that. What is shown here is for a couple of gravitationally lensed quasars, the fractional change in the C4 column density is a function of the transverse separation. And the big circles are complexes. The little dots are individual components. They're just as important. So they look as important on this diagram, but they're just as important. What you can see is that if you get to about 100 parsec, there seems to be some change. So a lot of these systems are certainly much smaller than 100 kpc, and maybe very small. So what do we conclude from that? Well, first of all, there exists an enormous population of highly enriched compact intergalactic gas clouds. Most of the metal transport into the IGM may be through these little clouds. And the intergalactic metals might be very badly mixed on small scales, which would then have the implication that all but a negligible fraction of the baryonic matter in the universe may be of primordial composition. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Question?
I'm just curious, would the in this second part of your talk, would it lead to an homogeneity of the IGM that would cause troubles with your first part of the talk?
Good question, no. Because most of these would be in pressure equilibrium. So the density and temperature would be the same as the environment. And when we do the ionization analysis, all we assume is that from the hydrogen colonizer, we can infer the density. And whether the metals within that cloud that are at the same density and temperature are inhomogeneously distributed or not doesn't matter. What is important to say, though, is that when we measure the scatter in a metallicity for a given density, there is a smoothing scale in there. And that smoothing scale is a smoothing scale to Lyman alpha, which is about 100 kpc. So when we talk about the scatter, we're talking about scales of about 100 kpc.
Now, as you have now measured the density of these systems, do you get now the C3 over C4 right with this density, or is it still a problem?
No, we get them right, although for most of them it's not so interesting, because most of the C3 is so contaminated that you always overpredict it. We never underpredict it, which would be a problem. I can look up a figure for that, but it's only for about half of the system that we cover C3, and those half, it's all fine.
One of the things this might seem sensitive to is actually the choice of radiation field, which you skipped over, but clearly we're going to talk about. I mean, clearly trying to measure the density from oxygen 6 and nitrogen 5 ratios to carbon 4 does depend fairly critically on whether it's the galaxian type dominated or quasar dominated type spectrum. And indeed, these type of systems are common in the proximity region of the quasars themselves. I mean, there are large numbers of systems that look very like this, that are close into the quasars. Not uncommon, there the AGN spectrum clearly has some sort of effect on the thing.
But I looked into that, it doesn't make a big difference. I should say first that all the statistics that we have on this indicate that these are intervening systems, at least relative to the quasar we see. It could be something nearby, the sideline.
Except you can see these which are not proximity systems. What I was trying to say was many proximity systems
I'll show you what.
May I just want to emphasize what Len was saying. In addition, some of them are less than 10,000 kilometers from the quasar spectrum, because it is my sample, or part of my sample, that's why I know it. Therefore, indeed, and they look very much alike, indeed, in terms of.
It doesn't matter anyway.
Column density, what is that you say, associate system?
I'll show you why it doesn't matter. If the radiation field is more intense or harder than the ionization balance that we would infer, you would give even more dense and smaller clouds. So it's really a softer radiation field that can change the qualitative picture. What I've done here is, this is the standard analysis. What I've done then is, I've assumed that all these clouds are in a Lyman-Bray galaxy halo, and that the radiation escapes with 100% efficiency. So it kind of maximizes the amount of soft radiation that you could get. And I've added that soft radiation to the extragalactic radiation field. And what you see then is that the results change as follows. I'll flip back and forth a few times. Density almost doesn't change, surprisingly maybe, but easily explained. And the size go up by about half a dex. So they're still far out of equilibrium, small things. All this stuff is, of course, order of magnitude estimate. The factor of 2 is that Jason is happy with, is optimistic for this stuff.
No, that was...
I have a question on the first part, actually. So when you're looking, particularly concerning your plot of tau carbon 4 versus tau H1, when you include the cooling, right? As the cooling time of a parcel of gas of over density delta is 3 giga, delta equal 1 at redshift 3 is 3 giga years, would you expect to see a kink where the cooling time, at the density at which the cooling time becomes equal to the Hubble time, and therefore you see some feature in that otherwise flat distribution?
Well, there's of course a distribution of cooling times, since there will be a distribution of metallicities and densities and temperatures. So I'm not sure you would see one feature. The cooling that we did here is clearly not realistic. As Simon already pointed out, the density should change as well. So it's just a, yeah, I mean, it's, what it shows, it's important.
Yeah. Two separate comments, on one on part one, one on part two. With regard to gas, which is cooling with metals, and the prediction of the ratios or the column densities of the lower ionization stages. Gas which cools out of equilibrium, and it even illuminates itself with its own ionizing radiation, and I've made some calculations in the past to predict this for the galactic fountain, and you get quite different results when you self-consistently take account of this cooling in predicting the carbon-4, the oxygen-6, the silicon-4 to carbon-4 ratio, and I don't see anyone doing this now. So once you realize you've got to put cooling in and your interest is in matching metal lines, you've got to do that.
I certainly agree for the metals. As I said before, for hydrogen, it's not important.
Now, the second part of your talk, this is a question. Could those features that you're identifying, if they are within 100 kiloparsecs of a galaxy, are they simply within the virial radius or within the halo, and could they therefore be associated with the galaxy? Pressure confined by the halo, a hot halo of a galaxy.
Could be. They, as I showed, they would still not survive for very long because they would be hydrodynamically unstable. Well, the ones that are the ones that have compact hats, they have a hadron structure that are 100 parsecs small in size, and they are in the process of being destroyed.
And which don't evaporate, okay, right. And I think it's because they're actually inside bigger computer structures, right? And I think that's where you run into a problem with sort of physical arguments that you're making, because I think if a mass of them, right, then it doesn't do that.
I'd like to come back to this. You had this very nice phase plot which showed metallicity versus temperature and also the density. So the color code here is the density, is that right?
Log over density. So
That's the total over density. Yeah. So you commented that this, you know, this doesn't correspond very well with what we see in the forest for several reasons at the end of that part of your talk. And what's not clear to me is a large fraction of the metals, as you pointed out, are at temperatures of almost 1,000,000 degrees and at fire high temperature. Presumably those don't show up in the forest at all because there'd be no associated H1, so you would not see the lines of hydrogen.
Yeah.
So which are the ones which actually show up in the spectrum? So when you do the spectrum statistics, which part of this plot is actually contributing to that?
Well, it depends a bit which element you're talking about, but generally for C4 and H1, it's roughly the same. If you go above 10 to the 5, you have to be at very high density to see it. So for the densities over that we're talking about here, that most of the stuff that you're still seeing well is that stuff, a little bit of that stuff, and over here it's almost invisible.
So I mean, the first conclusion from this is that even at redshift, whatever we're doing, 2 or 3 here, most of the metals are not in a form that's directly observed in the Lyman alpha forest at all.
That's true for this simulation, but we also know that prediction is wrong because we can compute the cooling times, and it's just not self-consistent. Most of that stuff should be cooling.
That's true. So then, but nevertheless, you do see metals associated with lines there. So the question is, for where you do see metals that are associated in the simulation, with hydrogen lines, how did the metals get into that gas? Is that, was that realistic, or how did that gas become cool enough to be seen?
You mean in a real universe or in simulation?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to explore is whether the mixing process in the simulations and the temperature which actually gives rise to observed things is realistic or not.
I don't think it is. And as I said, the cooling is only good. Also, what I mentioned is that the metallicity is probably, you know, at least in part, caused by the discreteness of the particles. So there's a lot of problems to be worked out for simulations still.
So I was just wondering, Chris Churchill and Jane Charlton see a whole bunch of these magnesium II systems that are remarkably similar, at least, you know, in my broad reading of them. Have you thought about what these would look like in magnesium II, and would they look like the same
things? Yeah, I've done that. So that's redshift 1. I didn't have time to go into that. What I did is I took one of these clouds and compressed and expanded it and see what it looks like. If it expands, then you don't see it anymore. Columns get too low, so that's fine because we don't see these things. If you compress it, you get one of these magnesium II clouds. So if you just keep the mass fixed, there would, of course, be much less of them at that redshift if you take the same number, because the cross-section would be smaller, so we wouldn't have been able to see them yet. We don't have enough statistics. But so it's certainly possible that they're connected.
I think there's also reason to believe that those magnesium II systems may be the edge of galactic winds. And at that time, they would be compressed. So the systems you're seeing be sort of consistent with, say, the remnants of a galactic wind, you know, the last little shreds.
Yeah, I agree.
Can you put this broad radius versus, for the second part, radius versus density for your the droplets? Yeah, so it seems like there's a trend with the density. And so
yeah, that
so would you speculate that you're actually seeing them expanding and turning into normal absorbing systems?
No, actually, this in our new analysis, you can see this much better why this is the case, or why it might be the case. Over here, we wouldn't be able to detect them, so that's clearly a selection effect, because there would be too small column density. Also, if you take a cloud with a fixed metallicity and a fixed carbon 4 column density, which is essentially what we select them on now, then you get lines that go like that. Here, you can't see it. If they were there, they would have to be extremely high in metallicity. And the other thing is that the arrows go in that direction, too. So it's possible that they go into normal population, but I wouldn't want to claim that.
Okay, thank you very much. And we will be talking to you.